kill the sin. There is a number of apologies that I should make before giving this talk. It is going to be very condensed. Many parts of it are more intuitive than relying on rigorous formalism. Perhaps I should say how I came to this subject. For many years, I've been studying quantum measurement with the following strategy. Let the measurement be delayed as much as possible. That is, rather than having this transition, abrupt transition from a superposition to a definite state, let's try by all kinds of maneuvers to delay this transition, because very interesting things happen in between. And more paradoxes came, some of which Lucian is involved. And I was more and more intrigued by those paradoxes. And therefore, I became involved in the search for a better interpretation of quantum mechanics. Apart from that, I always had an interest in the question of time, the nature of time in physics. And I came to the conclusion that the two problems are deeply related. And this is what I'm going to talk about. Here is the outline. I'm going to talk about something very strange, about, I would say, the most salient aspect of time in our experience that very oddly has no trace in the formalism of physics. Whether in relativity theory or quantum mechanics, the fact that time is passing, that there is some passage of time, is usually ignored or even denied or explained away by all kinds of maneuvers. I'll consider the consequences and I'll show that none of them, I'll consider the alternatives and I'll show that none of them is good. Then I'll talk about the why quantum temporal paradoxes tell us that there must be another way. Then I'm going to mention a very interesting relationship between three prohibitions in physics, one in relativity theory, the other in quantum mechanics, the other in thermodynamics, and I'll ask whether they're anyhow related to one another. So there will be two theses that I'll present, one by Valentini and one by myself. And then I'll come to the hypothesis of becoming, that is, I will try to make the passage of time, which is so far evaded, a basic assumption of physics, and I'll consider its consequences, which are quite many, and reaching even to field theories. There are two papers that we wrote that somehow relate to these issues, and they are here. Everybody is welcome to take them at the end. So what is it about time which makes it so unique among all other directions? Ask the man in the street and he will tell you, of course, there is a very fundamental difference between time and space. Events come, become, and go. There was Alexander Mukden and Genghis Khan and Napoleon, and they were born, did all their atrocities, and died. And you don't want to ask who is going to be the next tyrant to come and go. That's the common view. This is not what physics tells us. It would be silly to say that only Canada exists now, whereas Japan or Israel are non-existent because they are not given to our perception now. No, we say that all of them have the same degree of existence, and for the inhabitant of each country, his or her country is just as real as Canada is. Well, this is how you should relate to events in time. Past, present, and future just coexist in relativity theory as different places exist. You should think about the universe as a block of four dimensions in which all places, all events, in all times just have the same degree of existence. The feeling that things become and then vanish is, according to mainstream physics, just an illusion that you can explain away somehow by relying on the second law of thermodynamics and by some illusion of our brains. This is the common view. Forget about the passage of time. Just think about any future state that for you does not exist. And the answer in the physical formalism would be that it is only not accessible to your senses, but it just exists just as much as other places exist together with the place within which you are. Simple paradox in special relativity, it makes it very clear. You'll probably know it as the Bohn and Pohl paradox. Consider a spacecraft and a tunnel of the same length, and then let the spacecraft move very fast through the tunnel. So by special relativity, it should undergo the Lorentz-Fitzgerald contraction. However, this is relativity, and you can think about the whole situation in the other way. It is the spacecraft which is at rest, and the tunnel which is moving very fast. So it is the tunnel that should be shortened. Here you have two accounts of the same process which apparently contradict one another. In one of them, the entire spacecraft is within the tunnel. In the other, the two ends of the spacecraft come out of the tunnel at the same time. And of course, you understand that the solution is by dismissing the very notion of the same time. Here you have the histories of both the rear and the front of the tunnel and of the spacecraft. And for every person, the now, what is simultaneous, just varies according to your movement. So for one person, which is within the tunnel, and for the other observer, which is within the spacecraft, there are two histories, and they conflict just by choosing the now plane, but that means that all the events, past, present, and future, coexist, and this is how the paradox is avoided. Are you aware of the beautiful problem of Bell's two spaceships paradox? Consider two spaceships that make a decision, the two astronauts make a decision to begin to accelerate exactly at the same time, at the same rate, such that to an external observer, the distance between the two spacecraft remain just the same, not for the two guys who are in this frame now. They will complain, each of them will complain that the other did not comply with the previous agreement, and therefore the distance between them is becoming larger because the now plane is now shifted. Consequently, if there is a rope between the two spacecraft, it will break just because of the change in the distance, although for us stationary observers, the difference between the two spacecraft has remained the same. Once again, special relativity avoids all kinds of paradoxes by showing that the now plane differs from one observer to another. Few people, very small minority in physics, avoids this problem by going to the other extreme. This was so far the block universe. Some people go to the other extreme, which they call presentism, and they say, don't believe this talk about space-time. It's just some nice mathematical talk. What you should believe in is only the events which are now, and all the rest is just a matter of kind of way of talking, but it doesn't have a real existence. So forget about four-dimensional space-time, forget about world lines. They do not really exist. They are just theoretical constructs. Well, obviously, the cure is worse than the disease. It would be really a shame to say that all the beautiful geometrical relations that you see in general, special, and especially in general relativity, are only mathematical coincidences. Space-time, this is what general relativity tells us, is a real thing. It's something which takes part in any physical interaction, and not just something empty which within which things are happening. And dismissing space-time as something real would be just going back and losing the most interesting and profound insights of relativity theory.
What about the York time? I mean, if you have atomic relativity, there's unique time issues there.
Are you talking about proper time or what?
York time.
About
York time. So they use it in numerical simulations, for example. They can have unique choice of time.
Right.
Labeling the slices by extrinsic curvature and traces.
Sure, but it's still observer dependent. You don't have different observers
for. Well, everyone will agree with that because that's invariant.
Yeah, but let's agree there is one thing which is not there. There is no objective now which moves from past to the future, because that wouldn't help it.
Well, I'm just making comments when you move in general theory, there are preferred sciences.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
You can mathematically construct such things.
Yeah.
I mean, but
the problem remains. But the problem remains. If you want to say that there is some now which makes a certain event real, then the next event is real, and then the next event is real.
That's a good condition.
Right. But that's the most, once again, that's the most salient aspect of time which physical theory tries to avoid, and here are the reasons why. Most physicists would deny the coming. It might entail just yet a higher time. Just ask yourself, how fast is this now moving from past to the future? And then you seem to necessitate another time and another time, and it goes on to infinity, and you don't want that. And of course, it seems to entail absolute simultaneity, of which special relativity got rid of. Now here is the amazing thing, and here is the major grievance that I have to physical theories today, even those who are at the frontier of physics. Look how lavish theories are concerning spatial dimensions. They invoke superstring theories, invoke large numbers of dimensions, no problem. You don't have to be parsimonious about that, because in order for the equations to give you what you already know from physics, this is the large number of extra dimensions that you need. Other people will talk about hyperspaces, think about the many-world interpretation of quantum mechanics with several universes, zillions of universes with their four dimensions, all of which must somehow reside within a kind of a multiverse. Multiverses, of course, and then think about those brains according to new theories about the Big Bang, different brains floating in some hyperspace, colliding with one another, and then giving you the Big Bang, and so on and so on and so on. People are very extravagant, very generous with all kinds of hyperdimensionalities, all of which within the block universe. None of these theories is suggesting that the most salient feature of time, that is its passage, has any ground in objective reality. And that's a problem. This is why I'm going to take another path, which is much less traveled. Here is another question, which intrigued me for a long time. You have three prohibitions coming from three different physical theories. That is the relativistic prohibition on velocity is faster than light, quantum uncertainty, and the thermodynamic prohibition against entropy decreasing spontaneously. Could they be related? Well, one very bold idea is due to Valentini. In the beginning of the universe, there was overt non-locality, as well as quantum determinism. There was no uncertainty. Therefore, in that ancient universe, you could send superluminal signals, you could make supercomputers and do all kinds of feats which are considered today prohibited by physical theory. Then came entropy and kind of a heat death within those particles, and everything was scrambled. This is why today you see the world being local and obeying the rules of quantum mechanics. But what makes Valentini's theory very bold and very ingenious is that it is a scientific theory. He makes a prediction. He calculates the percentage of particles which are still in that pure, pristine state, dating back to the early universe, and he says, if you can catch them, if you can distill them, then you can send signals faster than light and create supercomputers, and so on and so on. Very bold hypothesis. The reason I hesitate to take it, or the reason I object to it, is aesthetic. It would be, how should I say, not aesthetic to believe that a beautiful theory like relativity is only fact-like, just the second law of thermodynamics, and not law-like, that this is just a coincidence due to entropy. I would like to believe that there is something more profound, that when a theory is very beautiful, it is not something fact-like, but really law-like.
Interesting with Einstein, he compared special relativity to thermodynamics.
Yes.
So he took the opposite.
I would claim him on my camp. in this respect. Let me show you why. Many years ago, in 1992, I wrote a paper in which I suggested that locality and indeterminism preserve a second law. And the idea was that if you have any, if you can show any determinism in quantum mechanics, that is, people are talking about hidden variables, but those hidden variables must be forever hidden variables. If they are ever non-hidden, and you can see them, you can detect them, then you can send superluminal signals. So quantum uncertainty somehow, not somehow, but in a very clear way, preserves locality. But locality is preserving the second law of thermodynamics. I showed in that paper that if you ever send superluminal signals, there will be some reference frames in which the observer will see entropy decreasing. Think, for example, about the torch in which I said several superluminal signals that hit many points on the wall. Then for a certain observer in the appropriate velocity, it will appear that different parts in the wall heat up and all of them converge on my torch. And you can show several other violations of the second law the moment that you have violations of locality.
That would be violations of the second law, right? Because in that theory, there's a preferred slice. You should make, the second law applies to this frame and not all frames. So you cannot just change the frame.
No, in the present theory, the second law applies to all frames. As long as these are relativistic frames that don't move faster than light.
Good. And the only difference you give is that, well, if you apply the second law to hidden variable theory, you should apply it to one frame.
Okay, so once again, so you violate locality again. So all I'm trying to show is that if you take Eddington's recipe and holding the second law of thermodynamics supreme, which Einstein tended to do, this is why I claim him for this camp, then quantum determinism would violate locality, non-locality would give rise to second law violations. I think that you can even try to think about a quantitative relation between the three. And actually, we should not be surprised by this relationship ever since the discovery of the Hawking-Bekenstein radiation or the effect, the Umbro effect. Somehow those three theories talk to one another in a way of which we are not aware yet. So here is what brought me to the picture that I'm suggesting today. Quantum mechanics shows you many paradoxes, some of which are spatial, others being temporal. A spatial paradox being, say, the double slit or the EPR experiment, the temporal being the delay choice, which is probably known to you, the Hanbury-Brownquist experiment, about which I'll talk. For some of you, it would be strange to think about Schrödinger's cat as a spatial paradox. Even to me it was, until a student came to me with an interesting question. She asked, what is the problem with Schrödinger's cat? You guys seem to be brooding about the question, has it been dead or alive or in superposition during the time in which it was in the box? There is no problem. Just look at the state of the cat. Make the experiment long enough such that the quantum event takes place at the very beginning, then let the box be sealed for, say, 3 days, and then you will find one out of two things. Either you will find a dead cat, which is also decomposed, so that means that it has been dead all that time, or you will find an alive cat, which is very angry at you with all kinds of droppings around and scratches, and that would indicate that it has been alive during all those all the time in which it was closed in the box. So you can tell that there was no superposition and that the cat was not superposed, but in either state. And it took me some time to think about her question until I found the answer, that this is actually a temporal paradox. The moment you open the box, you determine by your observation not only the state of the cat at the moment of the opening, but its entire history. Similar to the delay choice experiment, in which you can determine the history of one particle for millions of years, whether it went all its way to Earth, say a photon, as a wave which gave rise to interference, or as a single particle. So Schrödinger's cat belongs to this family of temporal paradoxes. And that was one of the ideas that gave us inspiration for the paradox that I am going to show you now. Once again, I'm going to close circle with Lucian, which, as you know, our scientific biographies overlap in a very beautiful way. So let me first introduce the Henry-Brown twist effect, which is a classical effect, but its quantum mechanical version is really amazing. And I'm always surprised that teachers and professors do not use it in their courses of quantum mechanics just to show students how amazing the quantum world is. Consider two light sources and one beam splitter and two detectors, and if you take care for the geometry and of course the two light sources are coherent, later I'll drop the requirement for coherence, but for the time being let them be coherent, then you will see interference even if the two sources are different. The amazing thing is that, okay, so here you have a beam splitter, then you can see that in one side the waves are in phase, in the other they are out of phase, so they give rise to interference. You can always be sure that by the geometry that you took care of, that only the right-hand detector will register the light. That's very nice, but consider the case in which the two sources are so dim to emit a single photon every once in a while. So you have single photons, and still all the photons are registered on the right-hand detector. One photon, two histories. Maybe with neutrons, you will get the same thing. It is one particle which came out of two sources. How could it be possible? Could each source somehow contribute half a particle in order to give rise to one particle? That's a very interesting thing. It tells you that in quantum mechanics, if you're uncertain about the history of something, uncertainty holds not only for the future, but also for the past. This is due to a theorem by Aharonov many years ago. Then that uncertainty suffices in order to give you two histories which are both required for the final result. So, then along came Hardy with a beautiful experiment in which he showed the following thing. I don't think that you can see it here. Let me just go back here. Here you have a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, and Hardy proposed to place two atoms on the two arms of the interferometer, and these atoms are made in a very special way. Prepare an atom in an X-up state, then split it, put it in a Stern-Gerlach magnet, such as if it is spin up in the y direction, it goes to one box. If it is spin down in the other direction, it goes to another box. So you have two such Hardy atoms, one here and one here, and one of the boxes crosses, intercepts the path of the photon. Now, the interesting thing is that if you get a click here, where you should never get a click, then you understand that either that atom collects to be in the intersecting box, whereas the other collects in the non-intersecting box, or vice versa, which is enough to entangle the two atoms. So you have an EPR experiment in which two atoms are entangled, such as to violate Bell's inequality, although they have never been in contact with one another. It is just a single atom that visited both of them and entangled them. So this is a work by Shachar Dolev and myself. We took the Henry-Brown twist experiment in its, also with Zeilinger. We took the Henry-Brown twist experiment with Hardy atoms, and the result is very neat. You have two sources here, which are very dim, emitting, say, one photon every few minutes. Then you place two Hardy atoms. So let me remind you, you take an atom which is spin up in the X direction. Then you let it go through a Stern-Gerlach magnet, such as if it is, and it is split along the y direction, such as if it is spin up in the y direction, it goes to one box. If it is spin down in the y direction, it goes to the other box. So this is one atom. The box is transparent for the photon, but opaque for the atom, so the atom cannot escape. Now you arrange it, this is a thought experiment, so let's not worry about technicalities. You arrange it such that if a photon passes here and the atom resides in this box, it will, in all the cases, absorb the photon. So the situation is unique in the sense that the photons are measuring the atoms, and the atoms are measuring the photons. I should say the one photon. So you don't know from which way the photon came. You don't know whether this atom is in the intersecting box or in the non-intersecting box, and the same with this guy. And then you run the experiment. Of course, you will have to discard the cases in which the one atom absorbed a photon. There are some cases in which the photon measuring the atom will collapse the atom to the intersecting box. And of course, the atom will measure the photon to have come from that origin. So in this case, you will have an absorption and you discard the experiment. But in a large number of the experiments, you'll get a very interesting result. Here are two hardier atoms which are not entangled. Each of them is in a superposition. Now, you run the experiment, wait for a while until you register a photon in the dark detector where you should never have received any photon. Okay? Had there been no atoms, then you will always get a click on the right, on the right-hand detector. But if you get on the left-hand detector, then the situation is very interesting. You understand that it is impossible that both atoms were in the intersecting boxes, because in that case you will get no photon. One of them is bound to absorb the photon. It is impossible that both of them were in the non-intersecting boxes, because then both sources are non-blocked and you should get a click in the normal place, in the normal detector, where you should get a click if there is interference. So they are now entangled. Either the right-hand atom is intersecting and the left-hand atom is non-intersecting, or the other way around. So here you have a very interesting situation. You have an EPR experiment in which the entangling event exists, so to speak, in the future of the two atoms. They've never interacted in the past, so the entangling event seems to occur even later. So you can think about it as a kind of a time-reverse EPR experiment, or as Schacher called it, RPE. Now, it turns out that there have been earlier versions of this kind of experiment. People who did nothing about time reversal suggested to entangle different two atoms in such a way, in a way similar to what we did, in order to improve some methods of teleportation. And when we considered that experiment, we found the following paradox, which we call it the quantum Lyer paradox, you know, the classical Lyer paradox, and here you have a quantum version of it. We run the experiment, and let me show you how, in order to explain the paradox, you have to, I have to remind you how you measure for Bell inequality violations. You have two atoms here. Now you run the experiment. How do you test for Bell inequality violations? You have to make, in one of the simplest versions, you have to make, to repeat the experiment many times, and then randomly subject each atom to one out of three measurements, three spin directions, whether 0 degrees, 30 degrees, or minus 30 degrees. Then you run the experiment many times. How do you measure the zero angle for the spin measurement? You just inspect one of the two boxes. This is a simple which box measurement. And in some of the cases, you will find the atom either in this box or in the other box. And the same for the other one. But that's another kind of measurement. In order to prove for Bell inequalities, randomly, you have to assign two other measurements in which you reunite the boxes. So you lose any information about the first direction, and then you split them according either to the 30 degrees or to the minus 30 degrees. Repeat the experiment many times such that you have an equal blend of all three measurements, and then when you compare them, you understand that something fishy was going on. This is just Bell's idea for non-locality. And this is the calculation, and you can show that nothing classical can give you that. These are the relationships between the angles. But here is the paradox. In some of the cases, you will subject one atom to the which box measurement, and it will turn out that this atom is in the intersecting box. That means that the other is in the non-intersecting box. There is only one histogram which is compatible with this, that no atom, no photon whatsoever passed from this path, only from this one, so there can be no entanglement between the two atoms. However, in other cases, you will subject the other atom to one of the two other measurements that you need in order to test for Bell inequality violations. You will find Bell inequality violations, which requires a kind of non-local effect, which means that the very decision of this atom to be in the intersecting box, which means that therefore it could not be entangled with the other, is due to entanglement. This is a new kind of a paradox. It stems not from some conflict between quantum mechanics and relativity theory or classical physics. This is a case in which, in quantum mechanics alone, nature is telling you a story which is a bit inconsistent. You end up with following history. One atom is found to have blocked the photon's path. Okay? It was there in the intersecting box. No photon could go through there. Hence, therefore, it appeared that it could not interact with the other atom. Therefore, should not be entangled with it. But by violating Bell's inequality, the very decision of the atom to have been blocked the photon was affected by the measurement of the other atom, which is just like saying this sentence was never written. It is the liar paradox in its quantum version. Now, of course, I know, if you believe in Copenhagen and you adhere to the Copenhagen interpretation, there is nothing strange about that, because you don't believe that there was any reality. And you know Wheeler's slogan, no phenomenon is a phenomenon until it is an observed phenomenon. However, nothing is strange in the Copenhagen interpretation. Show an adherent of the Copenhagen interpretation any crazy effects, and they will not be surprised. This is what makes Copenhagen interpretation not very interesting for our purpose.
So suppose this has never been written, and it's true, it's fine. Of course, you did read it, right? But where's the lie?
I tell you, this sentence has never been written. So?
Yeah.
The sentence, what do you think about the sentence? Is it a true sentence, or? The
sentence is false. But it's not quite a liar paradox. It's a liar paradox. If it's false, that should imply it's true. If I assume that this sentence is true.
Okay, yeah. I guess I should say this sentence is false or something like that, and then you will get the paradox. But what the quantum liar paradox boils down is to the same thing. One atom tells you, I am not entangled with the other. But then by Bell's inequality violations, the very saying of that atom, that it is not entangled with the other, is due to entanglement. So that I would say, is closer to the liar paradox. Let me show you another.
What was the reasoning that led to the statement one atom is not entangled with the other?
Let me show you just another version, which is even stronger, than you will see. Here is the Zoller and Chirac system. In this case, you can drop even the requirement for coherence. So you have two atoms which are in an excited state, and they are bound to emit a photon every once in a while. So here you have a beam splitter, and you wait for a while until one of the detectors registers a photon. Now, forget about interference or something like that. They don't have to be coherent. You just don't know which of the two atoms emitted that photon. So that means that if one of them is excited, the other is ground, and if the first is ground, the other is excited. So that entangles the two atoms, which means that if you find another measurement which is orthogonal to ground and excitant, then you can test for Bell inequality violations again. So you have an EPR state. But once again, if Bell's inequality is violated, in some cases you measure the atom, you subjected the atom to the test whether it is ground or excited. And if it is excited, that means that it never emitted any photon. But then by the very violation of Bell's inequality, that state of the atom, which is excited, which means that it never emitted the photon, which means that it could not have been entangled with the other, is still due to entanglement. You see the paradox. Forget about Copenhagen. You realize that any...
What is this, A? Solver and A1 and 2 stand for?
Oh, this is excited and ground.
Okay, but there's one... So these sources will produce one particle and then produce another particle?
No, both of them will produce only one photon.
So I mean, so you have a mechanism behind it like that?
No. This time we don't use any mechanism behind that. They don't have to be coherent. This is not, it is enough. All you need is the uncertainty. This one clicked, so you don't know whether this photon came from here and then was reflected, or if whether this photon came from this cavity and then was transmitted. You have an uncertainty, and that uncertainty is enough to entangle the two atoms.
But the way we, I mean, so
this is the work.
These sources would just produce local. I mean, one atom coming there, one atom there.
But the sources, the atoms stay in the sources and the photons are emitting. But you select on the case where you only detect one photon.
Sure, I should have said that. In some cases, you will get two photons, discard those, just as we did in the Hardy with the Hardy atoms. In some cases, you will get two photons, whether here or in both cases, discard them. Just take the cases in which you registered only one photon. Now you know that one of the atoms must be excited, the other must be ground, and you don't know which is which. That's enough to make them entangled. But that gives you the Lyar paradox all over again. And this is an experiment that has been carried out. One atom is found to be excited, which seems to indicate that it has emitted no photon. Then it could not interact with the other atom, so it should not be entangled with it. Just give me more time, I'll come to you later. But then by violating Bell's inequality, it's having preserved its photon, is due to entanglement with the other atom. Now, this is a part of a family of paradoxical experiments due to Aharonov and his group. They showed in several papers during the last 2 decades that if you subject a particle to two measurements, orthogonal measurements, then the state in between, the state of the particle in between is very paradoxical. There are some cases in which you are supposed to find an electron going in one arm of the Mach-Zehnder interferometer, but its charge is in the other, and other such crazier things. Here I quote Aharonov's personal communication. He does not believe in the block universe, although he never presented any systematic theory. But he says that in some real sense, every quantum event is visited twice. I'm now relying on Aharonov's two-vector formalism, according to which any quantum interaction is due to two-way functions, one going from the past to the future and the other back from the future to the past. Now, unlike Kramer, the proponent of the transactional interpretation, who in the beginning was an adherent of the block universe view, here, and we are in for a surprise later, here, Aharonov believes that there is some real sense in which a certain point in space-time is visited twice. First by the wave going forward and then by the wave going backwards. But of course, that's a very bold claim which goes out of the present physical formalism.
Can I just, so a slight quibble about the preceding experiments again. If you violate a Bell inequality, that means that if you want to model this experiment with a realistic kind of model, you need communication or influence, whatever you want to call it, between the two atoms, at least some of the time. It's not necessarily the case that you need it on every single run of the experiment.
I think
unless you have something like a GHZ violation, in which case
I take exception with you on the grounds of two things. First, there is a paper which is very old, quite old, from 92 or 93. I call it the EPR paper. In which we show that that normality holds for every pair in a part in an ensemble.
That's true for a singlet, and the reason for that is that you can make a GHC type paradox, like if you do the right measurements on a singlet. It's not true if you're only trying to model an experiment.
Okay, let's go your way and say the following, that Bell inequality violations or non-local effects occurred only in those pairs which were not subjected to the witch box measurement, or which were not subjected to the ground and the excited measurement. I can show you that it won't work. Let me just give you an intuitive argument, and then you can, I can show it to you mathematically. Consider three guys who play the poker, which is forbidden by the police. So a policeman comes and says, "What are you guys doing?" And one of them gives him a few dollars and says, "I was just watching." And the others, he asks the other guy, "What are you doing? What were you doing?" And he gives him a few dollars, you know, bribing him, and says, "I was just watching." And then he goes to the third one and says, "What were you doing?" And he says, "What do you think I was doing? If he was watching and he was watching, would I be playing myself?" That's the same situation here. If you want to take out those cases, you won't get Bell inequality violations. Bell inequality violations depends on the entire series. I don't think it will work. We can try it later.
You might be right.
Think about this case of the poker game. You will see it there. So here is my suggestion. This is how I suggest to explain this phenomenon. You know that in the Bolshoya Sovietskaya Encyclopedia, there is a large entry on the Bering Sea. And you would be surprised, why should the Soviet Encyclopedia give such a long discussion of the Bering Sea? You have to go to earlier versions of this encyclopedia in the days of Stalin, and you will find this guy, Lavrentiy Beria, who was the hero of the people and to whom there was a large entry dedicated in the Soviet encyclopedia. Then came Khrushchev and eliminated him, and of course you have to do something to take this guy out of the encyclopedia. So people went to houses and took the old editions of the encyclopedia, but what do you do with the remaining pages? So this is why you have the Bering Sea, which is so large. Is it possible that nature is doing something similar? That there are several histories, in some cases, history is being rewritten, whole segments of space-time, processes are being rewritten, and sometimes the stitches or the contradictions are too gross to be seen, and this is the source of these paradoxes. Let me just say that the paradoxes in themselves, I think they are sound. You could do the experiments, and this is what you will get. The interpretation is what I'm proposing now, and now my thesis begins. Let's do the following. Let's just take the idea of becoming, of dynamic time, and introduce it into physics. So let this assumption be made physical. Events are created anew, one after another in space-time, according to the Hubble order. At any moment in time in which one perceives as now, future events are not only unknown, but objectively inexistent, to be created later as the now advances. Now, of course, I'm running into all kinds of troubles once I try to introduce this kind of moving now, but let's follow it. Let's see what happens with that.
Clarification. What do you mean by now? Is it a global notion or a local notion?
This moment, we both are, okay. Do I want to bring any simultaneity or something like that? Let's leave the question open. It's a good question. But let's first begin with the assumption and follow it. Okay? So I do believe that has it been possible to look at the universe from outside of space-time to the extent that such a thing is possible, you will not see a block universe with all events, past, present, and future, coexisting, but you will see the events being added to one another. This is not presentism in the sense that I do think that past events have a special existence, and you do need those Feynman zigzags in space-time, I believe, in order to explain some quantum paradoxes. So it is not symmetric. The past is already there, the now is there, but the future does not exist, and the now is adding more and more events to those world lines, so those world lines are kind of being drawn by this process of becoming. It's very alien to the present physical thought, but let's follow its consequences. Could becoming be the ultimate compactification? When you look at a certain history and you say that it was created by becoming, then you acknowledge that there was something beyond the four dimensions that created that. I'm referring to all those paradoxes, life paradoxes and temporal paradoxes, which I described earlier. If you accept that a certain history that you see was written more than once, there were a few iterations and reiterations of that history. That could be a very good compactification. You can do with time what other people are doing with extra spatial dimensions. It might just work just as well and save you and make at least some of the dimensions unnecessary.
Yeah,
Now there is one consequence to this assumption of becoming, which is philosophical, due to math. But the insight for that is very important for relativity theory and for any future theory, for any future physical theory. If there are no events in the future, where there are no events, there can be no space, no time. This is an epistemological principle, but what if we make it ontological? That means that if there are no future events beyond the now, what we are going to do tomorrow or a week later is really inexistent. That means that there is not even space-time in the future. So space-time itself is growing together with the events. And that's interesting. It has a cosmological ring to it. We do accept that space-time was preceded by nothingness. There was first, before the Big Bang, there was nothing but not just empty space-time. There was no space-time. What we are suggesting is that what happened at the Big Bang is happening at every moment. There is nothingness, the ultimate nothingness, no space-time even, within which space-time is growing. So just this cosmological ring, which makes this idea more akin to the Big Bang, should be encouraging to follow it. Now people spread you with infinite times. I don't want to go into that. I can just show you that we didn't take presentism because we didn't want to give up the beautiful geometry of general relativity. Nothing forbids you to adopt presentism for the growth of space-time. So you don't need an infinity of times. Now here's a problem. You know, this is what Kant said. Time and space are necessary forms of any thought. Well, he didn't say that. He didn't prepare PowerPoint slides. But here is the problem that I have. When I'm preparing the PowerPoint slide, then of course I can't avoid using space and time. This is an inherent limitation to all the slides that I'm going to show now. And Henri Bergson was very clever when he said something similar. Never specialize time. Whenever we think about time,
who is this person?
Bergson, Henri Bergson, was a French philosopher. I think that it is about time that physics listens to what he had to say. There was a very beautiful meeting between him and Einstein, and Einstein admired Bergson. But Bergson did believe in the now, and it turned out that he was not well versed with the mathematical formalism of relativity theory. So his meeting with Einstein ended up very soon in a disappointment because they could not talk. So something was missed there, but it's about time to revisit the idea. He showed, in a philosophical move very similar to that of Kant's, that whenever you think about time, you can't avoid specializing it, thinking about it as a space, and that is the mistake that we are doing again and again. The beautiful insights of relativity theory take a price, because we can't think about time as pure dynamics. We always have to make some space out of it, and of course, I won't be able to avoid it even in this case, so let's be aware of that. That is the Bloch universe. So you have world lines of few objects, few particles interacting with one another, you know, annihilation, percreation, scattering, whatever. Now we don't want that. Do we want an alternative to that? Yeah, I should say, those of you who are aware of Cramer's interpretation of quantum mechanics, the transactional interpretation, you know that he was a very strong proponent of the Bloch universe view. Not anymore. During the last few years, he recanted, and he now believes in certain kind of becoming. So this is what he's saying, which is very surprising. So could we have a kind of becoming, people call it the growing Bloch universe, in which here is a now, and of course you're going to ask whether the now is universal, and let's avoid it for the time being. So here is the now, there is nothing beyond the now. So of course I can make this nothing, I represent it in black. So there is not even space-time there. And space-time is growing, such that history unfolds. That could be one possibility. Could we do it quantum mechanical? Now something interesting is coming here, a very interesting possibility, and that is the second assumption that I propose. Quantum interactions are strange. If we assume that there is kind of a moving now, and that there are no events beyond the now, and not even space-time, so many peculiarities of quantum mechanics can now gain a new insight if you believe that somehow The quantum interaction precedes space-time. We always think about the wave function as spreading within some empty space-time and then presenting all those non-local or atemporal paradoxes. What if the quantum interaction precedes space-time? So in this case, collapse gives rise, there is a wave function which tells you that the particle has an equal probability of residing in many places, and then you make a measurement, there is collapse, and it resides only in one place. This is a naive view. You think about the wave function spreading and developing in empty space-time. What if it is not the case? And if collapse gives rise not only to the particle in the place where it should be, but it gives rise to the entire region of space-time within which it could have been. That is the lesson I would derive from the interaction-free measurement. If you try to detect a particle and you did not detect it where it could have been, so the wave function collapsed and it is elsewhere, could it be that you did not just banish it, the wave function, from one place, but you just created the entire space-time region within which it could have been? So that could be, that's very radical, this move. It says that the space-time zone associated with this interaction emerges as its consequence, if it was not there preceding it and then letting the interaction take place. Something like that, and once again, forgive me for being so ridiculous, but how can you represent nothingness and the wave function interacting within that nothingness? Could it be that wave functions interact beyond the now, in that region which is outside of space-time, and then they give rise to space-time, to the associated space-time? If that is the case, then another theory, which is very interesting, it does not give you problems of interpretation, but now it comes in a very neat way. Could it be that the effects of special relativity could be explained this way? So we know that the speed of light...
One question. When you say that the wave function interacts outside of space-time, does that take time?
Once again, that is a problem that I cannot overcome right now. That is the problem which philosophers warn you. Is there some more primitive time? Is there some extra time? Is there some higher time? I don't know. Let's just consider that. Just make the assumption. You don't have to worry about that from the very beginning. Just take the assumption and see where it leads you. So I would say that even what you know from relativity theory, the speed of light, we know, much to the embarrassment of everybody who learns relativity for the first time, is more basic, more primitive than space and time themselves, speed of light. First, there is speed of light. That is the invariant thing. And then you derive spatial and temporal intervals according to that. Is it possible that this is also because the interaction, whether it is gravitational or electromagnetic, precedes the relative positions of the effect of the events? So time dilation, Lorentz Fitzgerald compression, others, and this is something about on which I'm working now, can occur due to the genuine dynamical attraction between the events. I'll show you later what I mean. And then, if you believe that collapse of the wave function gives rise not only to the position of a certain object in empty space, but to the entire space-time region within which it exists in one place and does not exist in another place, then that's the answer to your question. That could be that that becoming the now is not universal, but there are some dents, there are some peaks in it, which probably gravity is involved. So that means, and that's another problem within theoretical physics that has not found a solution yet. What is the master asymmetry? What is the master error of time? We know the cosmological error of time, the thermodynamic error, the electromagnetic error, and you're aware of all those debates, Hawking, Einstein, and Briggs, and others. Which is the master asymmetry from which the others can be derived? In this frame, becoming is the master asymmetry, which creates the space-time intervals between events, such that those with higher entropy will reside in a later position than those with lower entropy. And as you could see, with a relativistic C limit. So nothing can move faster than the speed of light, because the electromagnetic interaction preceded the space-time region within which it occurred. But then we can also reinterpret not only special and general relativity, but the very principle which underlies them. Mach's principle can now be elevated from an epistemological principle to an ontological principle. Position, rather than being defined by other positions, emerges due to the space-time interaction with these bodies. Okay, so think about inertia, think about the very position of an object, whether it is at rest or in motion, it is always in relation to other objects. Perhaps this is because the interaction between that object and the rest of the universe takes place first outside of space-time, and then another slice of space-time, another region of space-time is created. So then, and with this I'm ready to conclude, force is dynamized. If wave function upon measurement gives rise not only to the particle's positions and momenta, but also to the entire space-time region within which the particle could have resided, that means that this pre-space-time interaction determines whether the particles will be closer to one another or further from one another. You get attraction and repulsion from this idea that says that interaction is more primitive than space-time itself. And I know that I'm being very condensed and I bring so many wild hypotheses into one talk, but here is just the last one. Think about all those pre-Big Bang scenarios, string theories and so on, which talk about, some of them talking about several, many space dimensions, some of which became compactified and left only four in our universe. Why not continue with that and say that all those, this is a research problem, take all those scenarios and apply them not only to the Big Bang, but to every event. Think about quantum non-locality and apply those string models of the beginning of the universe to every moment. So think about the quantum interaction taking place in whatever those kind of space-times which existed prior to the Big Bang, and then every interaction gives rise to another region of space-time which emerges from that more ancient space-time. Non-locality becomes the most natural feature of such a world. Compactification could be the mechanism for quantum collapse, not only for the Big Bang. The problem with this approach is that this is a road which is the road less traveled. I'm unaware of any model which is trying to take this approach. You see all those other models which are so lavish about space dimensions and so on, but none of them is trying to take this most salient aspect of time to make it a basic ingredient of a theory. And then that road has so many forks, it has so many ramifications, that it is really overwhelming for anybody who is taking this assumption. There are so many possibilities. There is a huge family of theories that you can test, and you should consider all of them, which makes the work very overwhelming. But I believe that it is worth taking. Here's something that Minkowski said just before he died. What a pity to die at the dawn of relativity. But the dawn of relativity is long over. The sun of relativity is now high in the sky. But there should always be a dawn waiting for us. And it should always be a pity to die. Thank you very much.
I'm overwhelmed because I have many, many questions, but I'll restrict to just a few. Just first, some observations. It's actually not true that nobody is traveling this road. And let's not mention somebody called Joel Christian, but let's mention somebody else, Rafael Zorkin, who has been traveling this road for many decades, and he has this causal set approach, which incorporates many things that we talked about, including the dynamic time, including the actually, well, I'm not advocating that approach, but I'm saying that it exists.
Good to know.
Um, about the complexification of time, the idea that time, the Aharonov statement that it can be approached two different ways and so on. First, there is this whole temporal extra dimension. That's a theory called F theory, which is hardly heard about because M theory that take it over.
Oh.
But so there is a speculative idea of time being the extra dimension. So that's not new idea.
Is it true that once you consider that, then you can be much more parsimonious with spatial dimensions?
Let's not get it. I'm not advocating any of this theory. I'm just making some observations.
Why don't you advocate any of this?
Because I'm quite my own theory.
Okay.
The thing that I want to mention is I'm puzzled by Aharonov's statement. That is the most puzzling aspect of the whole talk that I found. And that is that you have this, you repeatedly come back to the same moment of time. That fundamentally contradicts the whole thesis of becoming. The whole notion of becoming, if you go back to the debate between Parmenides and Heraclitus, is that you can't step back in the same time. The time is not finished, over. It's transient, it's momentary, it's gone. It's got the memory left over. So this is not a presentism. It's not a presentism. This is a fixed background and open future. That is the notion of becoming. And so I find it very puzzling.
No need to be puzzled. One Steve Smolin said something very interesting. The Bloch universe is correct about the past, and presentism is correct about the future. You can combine, what is nice about this thing is that it can combine the advantages of the two theories. So think about space-time as something evolving. So if it evolves generally. And here, once again, you have a thermodynamic ring to this description. Macroscopically, it moves forward. But you can think about all kinds, at the microscopic level, you can think about all kinds of corridors or sleeves which are left still unfilled. And so there are holes in that, lacunes in that, that are later filled by a later event, by a later measurement. So I think that it's very natural. Think the only difference is the difference between the macroscopic and the microscopic. So becoming macroscopic, it goes forward. Microscopically, it can do all those things. Perhaps I should have said that would eliminate this argument. But I think that it is a very beautiful thing. Think about space-time as evolving, and then in some special cases, histories, micro-histories, can be reiterated. Not always, but in some cases. I think that it fits in very well. You don't have to be worried about that.
Again, I think there are many, many questions that one can ask, but let me ask you this. I'll give you this philosophical counter-argument, because you spoke of Bergson and people like this, something which is very problematic with this notion of becoming. If you think about this kind of branch and tree picture where the future is branching, so the past is fixed, and with the becoming, with this process of becoming, more and more things get fixed, go back to the past. If you think about this, you have to think about what you call becoming, and that's a problem that Bergson actually did not consider, which exists in, let's say, certain writings of Husserl, something like 10, 15 years prior to Bergson, because no one tells you that becoming is a sort of single-dimensional going forward process.
That's what I said.
There is nothing which tells you even that this picture that you've shown where the black thing goes up in a kind of single dimensional uniform way, there's nothing that tells you that the structure of becoming itself, so if you forget about the intuition of four dimensional space times and things like this, there is nothing that tells you that the structure of becoming itself is a linear kind of uniform motion forward. So people like Husserl, who understood this, did the analysis of the structure of becoming. And if you look at the phenomenological analysis of becoming, you see that the notion, the very notion of null is not a point that is moving anywhere on any straight line.
It now could be many nulls that
now can be fuzzy, now can have a lot of structure into it. So this makes problematic the whole idea of using the notion of null.
I would say that it doesn't make it problematic, but very fruitful. It gives you so many degrees of freedom that you need for the theories now that you want to integrate within one future theory. Why should that be a problem of the model? If the now does not have to be very clear, and this is, but on the contrary, and isn't it just what I'm saying, that any space-time region was preceded by something which is much more fuzzy, interactions which somehow took place outside of space-time. And it doesn't have to be a clear line. I never say that. That's a problem, that's a graphic problem that you don't know how to represent. It doesn't have to be a sharp dividing line. On the contrary, make it fuzzy, and then several quantum phenomena will become more natural.
When you're saying space-time is created by becoming, by the movement of now, where does it mean created? It's actually not created, somehow none of this is created, because the now can be large for some aspect, one now can be larger or smaller than another now. It depends on the way you analyze the structure of now. So how do you create space-time then? Then there is none of those space-times at moments can be said to be created. Because
no, just think about several space-times.
In a linear variable.
Yeah, think about several space-times, each of which is due to a certain particle, to a certain wave function, and then the interaction between them gives you one space-time which all of us share, but still holds those apparently contradictory aspects of the earlier wave functions. I still consider it as an advantage of the theory, because it does not give you one answer, but several possibilities. And this is how you devise a new theory. You don't throw away all the insights of the previous theories. You just take them as guides. So if the theory allows you several scenarios, then you go back to relativity and quantum mechanics and other theories and take their insights and then put some restrictions on the new theory that you want to make. So I still think that this is a feature that makes the theory feel very vigorous.
Maybe Richard first.
I was just wondering, it's very interesting. Is there any kind of theory that, is there any kind of experiment that your theory could that could either predict or invalidate your theory?
Unfortunately, no. Otherwise, I will be singing it from the books. It is not yet a scientific theory in the sense that I can't show you a single experiment that is bound to occur by the theory and that can refute it. Once I'll have it, I'll be very happy. I still think, and this is what I said in the abstract, this is a very preliminary model that hopefully can later become a theory.
Comment on this?
Certainly, probably there is no scientific theory that tells this, but if you look at people working in things where you will also speak about time, like decision theory and decision going in time, et cetera, in many, many different areas of science, people have been inventing some circular models or models of nonlinear development of time, et cetera, et cetera. So this whole tendency can be observed in many areas.
This idea of this sort of becoming of time, or this subjective impression of the flow of time. So, there are many debates which start off with this as a kind of datum, which is assumed we all have. And then the debate in the sort of conventional physics view, as you talked about, is that this is somehow an illusion.
This is the mainstream view. This is not my view.
Yes. And then an alternative view is that this is not an illusion, it's something real, we should include it. And at least, I think part of your talk, we seem to be finding using this notion
at least a form of words for talking about some of the paradoxes of quantum mechanics, which might make them seem at least a little less paradoxical. So, my question, what doesn't seem to happen very often is for this data itself to be talked about or analyzed. One could ask, is this really a data which is simply given to us? Or is it more something to do with the language and our own ways of talking about things? And I'm sort of, if I were an anthropologist or something, maybe I could come up with an example of some tribe who have completely different ideas about time or than we do. And so now just then talk in the same way. Now, if that's the case, one would be more suspicious of using this notion as something to drive forward ideas in physics, I guess.
So you're proposing to kind of remove that this is only a problem of culture, of language?
Well, it's a possibility to be considered. To the extent that it really is a sort of given data, then it certainly could be used.
Well, I think that this is something which is so basic and so inherent to our experience that it goes beyond the language or the culture in which you are. But there is a difference between space and time in the sense that in space I can move or stay, I can go backwards and forwards. Could you show me any kind of experience, unless you know, you're highly intoxicated or something like that, which so far, not even in the Brayton principles, we would not consider as valid data for scientific theory, but in any form of perception, you cannot remain at the same moment as you can currently remain in the same position. You cannot become younger. There is something which is very, very basically different between space and time. The Minkowskian geometry tells you that, this imaginary part of the T, which, by the way, if you ask people why is it so, why do we have the minus geometry, the answer is always, this is due to squares, I'm thankful for him, he wrote that. Why do we have this kind of geometry in which you have to give the minus sign of t? The reason is otherwise it won't work. Otherwise it would not give you the depth of relativity. So this is something that is introduced by N, but relativity acknowledges that time is very radically different from the other three dimensions. But then it leaves the matter there without any further answer. What I'm proposing is that it is becoming which makes time so unique.
Comment to your research. I think I don't know how reliable this is, but the scribe in Africa, and they interviewed them about relativity.
Right.
And apparently they didn't understand what it meant at the same time at another place. So I think this was an introduction to one of Einstein's books, I think.
Why do I still have suspicion, although I've never been in that tribe, that if two guys set up a meeting and one of them does not come in time, the other will be just as mad at him as he would be.
Yeah, sure, but that's at the same place. What does it mean to say, so that was the question. Do you understand what it means?
That's true.
But there's a different spatial location.
Statements like the present exists, the future does not exist yet, but it will exist. These kind of sentences you can imagine not having good.
Yeah, you're in trouble once you do that. Once you do that, you're in trouble. You have to go beyond space-time. You have to go beyond the four dimensions in order to do that. This is what I'm doing. People are going beyond the four dimensions in order to create string theories with all due respect, with all other dimensions. I'm going beyond space-time just with one thing, which is becoming. You have to go beyond the four dimensions. This is why most people shy away from such a move. They don't want to step so much out of the mainstream, but this is something that I think that it is about time to do.
So, I just had a question about this Liar paradox, which is confusing. I just want to understand exactly why it's called the Liar paradox. Couldn't one say that any measurement in quantum mechanics involves that aspect? I mean, if I measure a particle and I find spin up in the x direction, then the particle is sort of telling me I'm spin up in the x direction. But I know that the state I know that I'm entangled with a particle. Why am I measuring apparatus as entangled with a particle? So the particle is the mind.
You make an idiot abstract, okay? So
right.
you and your friends with entangled particles, you made a spin up, you get spin down, which is very strange because, you know, it took place, whatever measurement one of you did must have affected the other one at the same time. Liar paradox? The problem is only with locality. What I'm showing here is that you have a particle. In the EPR experiment, you have particles which have something common in the past. They came from the same source. So whatever is happening is that they are entangled by a past event. Now here you subject the particles not to the question, which spin are you in the X direction? Which spin are you in the Y direction and in the Z direction? You do another thing. You ask, which spin are you in the X direction? Which spin are you in the Y direction? And are you entangled with your friend? Is there any common event between you? These are the three questions. In some of the cases, it tells you, there is no common event between us. I'm holding my photon. I am an excited atom. There is no way I could be entangled with the other guy, with the other atom. But then, by Bell's inequality violations, this very answer, which indicates that it is not entangled, is due to entanglement. That is, I would say, something akin to the Liar paradox. The paradox here has nothing to do with locality or with relativity or classical physics. It is a case in which quantum mechanics itself gives you kind of an inconsistent history. I think that the paradox is more profound. Of course, other things are paradoxical. But, okay.
One point on this is the model of what happens in this experiment, not in the current data, but in the volume interpretation, for example. And it can provide a consistent.
Yeah. Oh, that's, yeah.
But the volume interpretation is good, based on the right hand examples.
I should mention another controversy, which I heard with Lucien about one of his most ingenious experiments, in which we take exception with you and you know the story. I have this to say about Bohm's interpretation. During the years, at the beginning, Bohm's interpretation tried to restore some part of classical intuition and bring it back integrated within quantum mechanics. Then people came up with more and more amazing experiments. And then in order for Bohmian mechanics to accommodate with these experiments, it adopted more and more strange features of the quantum world, such as in one case, I believe it was a paper of yours, or a letter at least of yours, which you say that by Bohmian mechanics, you could have a particle in one place and its mass or its charge in another place. Harvey Brown. So then you ask once again, is the medicine better than the disease? I mean, here is a theory that tried to bring some classical intuitions. Then it became more and more exotic, more and more peculiar, such that it is almost like
so
Copenhagen.
The model theory, its complete version, is written down 1927, so it didn't change.
Actually, you have some problems in order.
So,
I mean, in what
sense did it change?
I mean,
the
specific substance doesn't change, but it's changed as the understanding of it. The applications, because there were some experiments which were not known to Bohm. Okay, so very, very interesting experiments, especially those of the last two decades. So then in order for Bohmian mechanics to account for them, you don't change the theory, but you have to acknowledge in the theory, you don't change. Some very bizarre phenomena. So then you ask, what is the guide wave or pilot wave good for? It restores at least one classical intuition. Yeah, when you deal with things like the double slit or the Mach-Zehnder interferometer, then you can understand part of the wave is split into two, the particle is riding in one half, and then you get all these things. But once you are told that the particle is on one arm, and then other properties of the particle, corpuscular, not wave-like, are in the other place, then the theory becomes so bizarre that...
Well, over 1923, that the causal theory is a wave and the particle.
This is why I come back to a very wise comment made by Einstein when De Broglie went to him with his new theory. I mean, of all people, Einstein should be the happiest person to see De Broglie's idea that you shouldn't ask a wave or particle, just wave and particle. Einstein should have been the happiest person when to hear that. You know what he called for the point. It's too cheap.
But that's both in fact.
But actually, that's the comment in a letter to Schrodinger that Einstein, that's not the full comment, it's something like this. Have you seen that Bohm thinks that he can solve the problems of quantum mechanics with inverted
That
seems too cheap to me. So
Einstein was employing an aesthetic criterion.
Yeah.
And you know, you should be very careful with aesthetic physics. But
sometimes it's a serious problem with non-locality. He didn't like the fact that Rome was non-local theory.
I would say the following. Here's my comment. Suppose that I come to you with a new theory and I tell you the following. I can explain to you my theory resolves the wave particle duality. Okay, and it resolves another thing. And then you ask me, does it resolve the Schrödinger the measurement problem? I say no. That one it does not resolve. Let's wait for another theory, which we shall amend to it, and it will resolve it. Does your theory resolve the problem of non-locality? No, I assume non-locality. So if you have to deal with the problem with locality in another way, aesthetically, I would expect I might be wrong. That one day when you have a theory, you know, you all know what Wheeler says, and now we are just playing with citations. Wheeler says one day there will be a theory that explains these things, and our reaction to it will be so beautiful, so simple. How come we didn't think about it so far? How could we have been blind so long? Is there any of the theories now that you see, any of the interpretations now available that makes you think like that?
That's a good place to start.
Thank you very much.